This talk was part of Marxism 2010, A Planet to Save, A World to Win. The conference took place on May 28th through 30th at the Ryerson University Student Center. For more information, please visit www.marxismconference.ca.
There it goes.
Okay, so good morning, everyone, and thank you for coming. Just before we begin, we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge that this building occupies the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nations land, and as settlers coming together in this space, it's our collective responsibility to respect and regard this land as being the traditional territory of the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nation, and to recognize that this land is currently under claim. So thank you, everybody, for coming to the session today. The new McCarthyism, Harper's attack on Palestine solidarity. There's certainly lots to talk about on this issue. We've got a fantastic panel, and thank you to the speakers for coming here on Saturday morning at 10 a.m. and to all of you for coming. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to introduce all the speakers all at once, and then you can applaud and welcome the speakers after I've introduced all of them. And then Rafiq will be our first speaker. So Rafiq Diatta, who needs no introduction, is a leading figure of the Palestine solidarity movement. She's a founding member of the Coalition Against Israeli Apartheid and is a leader in the BDS struggle, not just in Toronto, but around the world. Khaled Muammar is the president of the Canadian Arab Federation and a longtime supporter of the peace and social justice movements in Toronto. Dylan Penner is a founding member of Independent Jewish Voices. He's also a founding member of the Toronto Coalition to Stop the War and is active in the Canadian Peace Alliance. And Tim McCaskill is a gay, anti-racist activist based in Toronto, who's also a member of Queers Against Israeli Apartheid. So please welcome all our speakers to join us. And we'll start with Rafiq.
Thank you so much, James, for the introduction, and thank you all for making it at 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning. As you see, I'm still holding my coffee. So I'll try to be as coherent as I possibly can. It's not very good coffee, but coffee nonetheless. I think it's very important as we speak of the new McCarthyism to recognize why it's happening. And we're in May, and May is the anniversary of the Nakba, the Palestinian catastrophe, where this year we are marking 62 years since the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Since 750,000 Palestinian refugees were expelled, more than 500 villages destroyed, with the establishment of the State of Israel. If it wasn't for the Palestinian people holding on to our land, if it wasn't for the Palestinian people struggling for 62 years to say that we exist and we have a right to self-determination and to live in freedom, there would not be a new McCarthyism, and there would be nothing we're speaking of today. So we owe our struggle and everything we do to the steadfastness of the Palestinian people. And second, it's very important to recognize that if it wasn't for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, there would be nothing to repress. This new McCarthyism is not very new. Palestinian advocates have had to handle smear campaigns and things flung at us since we started doing Palestine organizing. What's different is in the context of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign, with the call coming from Palestine in 2005, what has happened is the movement has gained coherence, and we are putting forward demands that are very clear that speak about the entirety of the Palestinian nation. So grounding all of our work and this discussion in the history of the Nakba, the Palestinian catastrophe, and in the struggle of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign, I think is the grounding for this discussion. Otherwise, we're really speaking about the repression aspects and freedom of expression without dealing with why the attack on Palestine organizing is very heavy. What is the context of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign? The call came out from Palestine in 2005, signed onto by 170 Palestinian civil society organizations representing all aspects of Palestinian organizations, from student unions, labor unions, women's organizations, refugee camp organizations, signing on to three simple demands. But the simplicity of these demands is what makes them very strong and effective. One being ending the occupation, dismantling the apartheid wall, and freeing the more than 11,000 Palestinian political prisoners. Two, equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel who are treated as second-class citizens. And three, second or third class citizens, and three, the right of return for Palestinian refugees. Those demands encompass all sections of the Palestinian nation. When Israel was first created and Palestinians were dispersed, We were split into refugee camps that were outside. We were split into Palestinians who remained in what is today called Israel, and those of us who were in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. So these three demands speak to the entirety of the Palestinian people. And this is why the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is so dangerous, and there is a repression for it, because it's speaking for justice for all of Palestinians, not just a section of Palestinians. The other reason the BDS movement is dangerous and there's so much repression against it is because it's a very practical way for people around the world to show solidarity with Palestinians. It's not simply rhetoric. It's not simply saying we want to call for justice and do nothing about it. Until the BDS call came out of Palestine, a lot of the advocacy was essentially responding to massacres, making sure we are out on the streets when Israel is committing massacres, making sure we're doing educationals around apartheid and what apartheid means, but actually having nothing practical for people to do. And what BDS gave us was something that connects us with the struggle in Palestine and us taking responsibility for what governments like the Canadian government do in support of Israel, actually outing the corporate connections between Canada and Israel, outing the government's connections between Canada and Israel, is what this BDS campaign was able to give us. So something that can give you a good analysis with specific goals coming out of Palestine, very coherent, and actually gives you a step forward of action is something very dangerous, because you have two things in one movement. You have analysis that is not shallow, analysis that encompasses the Palestinian nation, and you also have action of things people can practically do to support Palestine. Something that coherent hadn't happened in a long time in the Palestinian movement because of the so-called Oslo peace process and the confusion that brought around. Before Oslo, there was very advanced international solidarity with Palestine. The problem is under the Oslo peace process, it all collapsed. And within the Second Intifada, we had to be rebuilding from scratch all of these new networks, and the BDS campaign allowed us to do that. So this is the dangerous part, and this is why we're seeing this new McCarthyism attacking different sections of organizing within Toronto and outside of Toronto. I, of course, have to say that I congratulate every activist in Toronto. We have been very lucky to be called a hub of Israel delegitimization. I think that's a badge of honor we should all wear proudly, to have become a city that's seen around the world in the BDS movement and by Israel, this is by their own admission, as a very strong place where Israel legitimacy is attacked. And any state that's an apartheid state, its legitimacy will be attacked around the world, and people of conscience will be there to organize against it. So congratulations to all of us. And as we hit the 5-year anniversary of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions call from Palestine, I think what's happening in Toronto is something we should all be proud of and continue to do in an actionable way. We have, when we first began and we initiated the Coalition Against Israeli Apartheid, people thought we were a little nuts, to be honest with all of you. They said, why don't you call it Coalition Against Israeli Occupation and speak about the West Bank and Gaza Strip? That will be much easier, and you'll be able to get people. And others said, why don't you only speak about international law, Resolutions 242 and 338? The majority of us, actually, though, who initiated the Coalition Against Israeli Apartheid were Palestinian refugees. And for us, the struggle for liberating Palestine has always been about our right to return to our homes and lands from which we were expelled. It's not about returning to the West Bank and Gaza in the form of Bantustan. It's actually for equality for everybody who lives in that area. So we pushed really hard for the term apartheid to be used as an analytical term, but also as what the struggle meant for us. Having the West Bank and Gaza Strip free in Bantustan formation does not resolve the Palestinian question. It would be great. I mean, Israel is not going to do that either, but it does not resolve the Palestinian question. So having said all this, I wanted to contextualize this within what's happening. And it's very important that we were able to initiate something called the Coalition Against Israeli Apartheid and continue for 5 years. And with the anniversary happening this year, not just think of the repression we're facing, even though I think the repression is a good gauge of how well we're doing, but also think of how we're going to move forward as a movement and keep building the different BDS campaigns that we've started. Needless to say, there's been enormous resources marshaled by conservative and Zionist organizations in attempts to silence any criticism of Israel, but also in an attempt to silence any criticism of Canada's support for Israel. As most of you know, the Harper government has uncritically supported Israel. The one comment that will always be in my mind was as we're demonstrating against the bombing of Lebanon, and Harper says this is a measured response, what Israel is doing, while all of the civilians were dying. So he's always given uncritical support. I know we like to beat on Harper, but Marston also gives support, and the Liberals also give support. So Canada has a long history of support for Israel. So all of these resources are not just being marshaled. Wow, I have 5 minutes left. All of these resources are not just being marshaled in order to silence criticism of Israel, but also to silence us from being able to criticize this government, the Canadian government, which supposedly people here elect and should be speaking for all of us. There are two main arguments that are always used against us in this new McCarthyism. One is that when you criticize Israel, it's anti-Semitic. They have coined the term the new anti-Semitism, and they are saying that any time you criticize Israel, it's basically anti-Semitic. There's books about this I could give references. It does not make sense to say any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. Israel is a state. They're always kicking up a storm about how it's a normal state, it should be treated as any other state, except when you criticize it should be treated differently. It's a state, it's an apartheid state, and we all have a right to criticize it. Also, there are many, many, many anti-Zionist Jews who are beginning to criticize the Israeli state very, very openly. Now, the other argument that's usually used is that saying Israel is apartheid is offensive, and it creates an atmosphere that is not a good atmosphere, and that's why we need to stop using the word. I personally find this argument completely ridiculous. It's very multicultural Canadian, of course. They have taken the rhetoric of diversity and inclusion and turned it on its head to the point where they use it to silence other people. And I think the case of Kwaya is a very obvious case where they're saying when you use the term, it's going to scare everybody and it's just offensive to everybody. I just want to say that on Canadian campuses every year there are Israeli soldiers that are paraded around as heroes. These would be people who participated in bombing Palestinian homes and villages, and nobody ever says that that's offensive. So you see the double standard in what is considered offensive. Also, since when is political speech shut down on the basis of being offensive to a group of people? And this is, I think, what the BDS movement has been able to blow up in its entirety. It's this question of whose voices get heard when we speak about being offended and not being offended. And the fact that the Palestinian movement is always the one pointed out as being offensive, and everything else, including parading around war criminals, is treated as if it's normal. And here I could ask anybody who lives in Canada, how many times have you heard a Palestinian on TV that they don't show a short clip of they're either screaming or shouting, and that's all they're going to show of any Palestinian, and that's the Palestinian image that's going to be put forward, but the Zionist image is always calm and inclusive in some odd way, even as they're bombing Gaza to smithereens. There's been many cases, and everyone else on this panel will be able to elaborate on the cases, the cutting of funding to the Canadian Arab Federation, the banning of George Galloway from being able to come, the banning of the posters of Israeli Apartheid Week. Israeli Apartheid Week started right here in Toronto. This year it's grown to 60 cities around the world. So this is the other side of the coin. It's true that they're trying to shut it down. And B'nai B'rith, by the way, when the Kwaya decision came out, the decision from Pride to ban the term Israeli Apartheid came out, B'nai B'rith put out a press release congratulating Pride and saying now university administrations should do the same and ban the term Israeli Apartheid. What's important for all of us around this, I think, because we can go on listing the different ways that we're being repressed, but what's important for us, I think, two things, and I have 2 minutes left, and I'll say them in 2 minutes. One is that we need to continue the organizing that we do. We are facing this repression because of the solid organizing we've been doing. So the only way to combat it is to just keep doing. What they want is to close us down and make sure all we think about is how to defend ourselves, and all our resources go into defending ourselves. We have to defend ourselves, but we have to keep doing what we do. And the second important thing that we all need to think about is this is not just about shutting down Arab Palestinians or Arab and Palestinian solidarity. This is about taking back any gains of the progressive movement. And if we let them do it now, it's not going to stop at this. This is about our ability to criticize the Canadian government when they support wars. It's about our ability to take our spaces, the ones that we have created as fighting spaces. Pride was created as a fighting space. So this is about taking back and protecting our spaces. It's not a marginal issue out there. It's become a freedom of expression issue for everyone here. And that's because apartheid tends to spill out of its own boundaries. For Israel to exist as an apartheid state, it needs to be protected everywhere, and any criticism of it needs to be shut down everywhere. So our fight against apartheid is a fight for taking back our own spaces, taking back our own spaces that we've created for free expression, and also continuing to fight until Palestine is free. Thank you.
Thank you, Rafiq. Our next speaker will be Halid Mumar.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. I would like to continue from where Rafiq left and try to understand why this government is supporting Israel and why is it engaging in this attempt to muzzle the Palestine solidarity movement. We have a government that's driven by a neocon ideology, which is guided and caters to Christian fundamentalists on the domestic issues and Zionists on the international issues. And to be able to implement this ideology, they engage in policies which demand conformity. So any debate or diversity which has been supposedly a tradition in Canada is not accepted, and they engage in smearing and demonizing any opponents which they view as opponents by calling them either anti-Semitic or supporting terrorism or not being Canadian sufficiently. And they engage in bullying and blackmailing, pitting the communities against each other, and they try to do that with the Jewish community and the Arab community by playing these against each other. And they even engage in attempts to change and appoint leaders in these communities. And I will mention that later. Now, the first action by the government of Harper when they took power was to scrap the Core Challenges program, because they knew that vulnerable communities would be able to resort to these to challenge what they're doing and to fight for the constitutional rights. And one of those rights, as was mentioned, is the freedom of expression. And they have also resorted to using blackmail by cutting funding to groups or threatening to cut funding. They cut it to our organization, they cut it to Kairos, they cut it to women organizations, to Pride Parade. They even threatened to cut it to a conference which was held by York on the modalities of Israel's state, Israel and the Palestine. So these are tactics that they've used. And to smear groups and individuals, they have been helped by the Zionists in that, and I refer specifically to NGO Monitor, which is based in Jerusalem, the Jewish Defense League, which seems to have a direct line to Jason Kenney. He was advised by them on the Galloway thing, and Erwin Kotler, who has been really working jointly with Jason Kenney to set up this coalition, the parliamentary coalition to combat anti-Semitism. They started the first meeting in London in March of 2008, which was the initialization of that movement, parliamentarians around the world, and they're holding a conference of that organization, the international part, next year or this year, I'm not sure. This year, in Canada. So these the JDL, B'nai B'rith, NGA, NGO, the Monitor, Erwin Kotler, are really the ones which are backing the government fully on the Palestinian issue. And this is why you see whenever there's an action by the government, it is preceded by attacks by one of these organizations against an NGO like CAF or QP Ontario or Israeli Apartheid Week or York University and all of those. And they resort to smears like which are really ridiculous. For example, Kenny accused the university, York University, of committing pogroms against Jews on campus. And James Lacter answered back and said, I've been a professor at York for 20 years and I've never felt any threat as a Jew. So what is most serious in all of this is that the government has also attempted to really implant leadership in these communities which they feel are not towing the line. And I'll talk specifically of the Arab community. When we were accused of promoting hatred and anti-Semitism and supporting terror, they contacted individuals and some leaders in the community and approached them and met with them through a carrot to them and told them, if you change the organization, we have no problems with this organization. We just have three conditions. You get rid of two individuals on the organization, Khaled Muammar and Ali Mullah. You drop the legal case against the government, and you stop dealing with international issues. Just talk about domestic issues. And this attempt was a serious attempt. People were confused. People said, you know, we cannot fight this government. It's a government that's backed by the Zionists. Let us swallow this our pride and accept it. And it was really a dangerous period because we knew if that happened, many of the solidarity groups which are standing with us in Canada would be also intimidated, and they would say, if the Arabs caved in, why are we sticking our necks out? So these are the things that they've done. And Jason Kenney has done it not only with the Arabs. The Somali community, for example, he set up an organization headed by someone who used to be a liberal, and now he's trying to make that organization as a spokesman for the Somali community. And this organization supported the Ethiopian invasion of Somalia, the changing of the government in Somalia, and so these are the kinds of things they do. At the same time, they try to give always a platform to people who are marginal in the Muslim community and make them spokesmen for the Muslim community by saying these are the good Muslims and the rest are bad Muslims. So this is a tactic where they try within the communities, which are the vulnerable groups, to undermine them and to... So they have been undermining democracy in Canada. They took over the Rights and Democracy Organization. They changed the leadership there. And they're attacking any organization, any Canadian organization which does human rights programs outside of Canada, in Congo, in the Middle East, in South America. They make it conditional that the funding that they give to these organizations should not challenge the status quo in those countries. And they set up, as you'll be talking about, CPCCA, which is attempting to prevent any discussion about Israel. And they've done this also, in a sense, the smearing campaign is not being done only against people who support the Palestinian struggle. It's being done also against people who oppose any government policy, be it in Afghanistan, Richard Calvin, who was a diplomat, who appeared in front of the parliament and spoke about the knowledge that the government had that the prisoners were being given to the Afghani authorities were being tortured. He was accused of being a dupe for the Taliban. So these are the tactics that they use all the time. So we have a government then that says we are guided by these principles: freedom, democracy, human rights, and international law. And let us analyze if this is true. In both of Palestine and Afghanistan, they are supporting occupation and oppression. They are supporting in Afghanistan warlords and drug lords who are oppressing their people, and in Palestine, they are supporting an apartheid regime. With regards to democracy, they are threatening the democratic freedoms that we have in Canada by undermining the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which allows us freedom of expression. When it comes to human rights, they have completely marginalized the main organization in Canada, which is Rights and Democracy, and they have supported countries which violate human rights. And finally, when it comes to the rule of law, they stand firmly with governments which are violating international law. In the case of Israel, occupation, settlement, building the wall, all of those. So this is a government which is really guilty of crimes against freedom, democracy, human rights, and international law. And we have a fight ahead of us, which is a strong fight. But as I see it, they are becoming more vicious. They are becoming more reactionary with the support of the Zionists because they feel that the public opinion is changing. They still have the support of the establishment through the mainstream media, through even the political parties like the Liberal Party is somehow going along with them, and the NDP is really silent on this. But they know that they have to become more repressive, and we have to know that this will happen. But in the end, the Americans went into Cambodia and Laos because they thought that they were losing in Vietnam, and in the end they did lose. And I believe that this government will fail and the Zionists will fail because the people in Canada are becoming aware that they stand against all these values which they claim, and they are supporting oppression, apartheid, human rights violation, and violation of international law. Thank you.
Thank you, Howard. Our next speaker will be Dylan Penner.
Thanks, and thanks everyone for coming out. Just to start with a brief disclaimer, according to Harper, CJC, Denai Briss, and the rest, everything you're hearing on this panel is anti-Semitic, and everything I'm about to say is anti-Semitic, too. So, with that, I'm a founding member of Independent Jewish Voices, as James mentioned, and this sort of highlights the desperation of our opponents a little bit, that, you know, as we've heard, there's a range of organizations that, whether they support the Palestine Solidarity Movement as an active campaign, or in the case of groups like Rights and Democracy, funded a couple Israeli human rights organizations, are branded anti-Semitic. And it goes to the extent of saying even a Jewish organization, if it even hints that Israel is maybe not perfect, which we do go farther than that, and I'll get into that in a second, we are also anti-Semitic for saying such things. So this is the propaganda of the new McCarthyism, where even organizations like IJZ, along with the others that were mentioned, are labeled as anti-Semitic. Now, if you start pointing out Israel's war crimes, and you even mention the A word, then watch out. So just to add a little context to what's already being said, I think the new McCarthyism goes hand in hand with a couple other key elements, particularly in the Canadian context, and that's the new militarism, which is certainly not something that originated with the Harper government, but is certainly something that's been escalated, and what the real new anti-Semitism is, and that's Islamophobia. And these things go hand in hand, and we need to recognize that. And just like a school bully, our opponents, particularly in the Harper government and the so-called Jewish lobby, which I think we need to not refer to as the Jewish lobby because they're not really representing the interests of the Jewish community, and I'll get into that in a moment as well. But their power depends on us being too afraid to act, and as we can see, many, many people are refusing to be afraid to act, and that's why we are seeing this lashing out escalating. And they've forgotten, just like the school bully, that eventually people become too angry at the injustice of the situation not to act, and that's why we're here talking about it today. So just in terms of a little extra context, as I'm glad the previous speakers touched on, there is a direct connection between this new militarism and the new McCarthyism, the attacks on the Palestine Solidarity Movement, and the very deepening support for the war, particularly in Afghanistan. And one thing that perhaps we don't talk about enough is the deepening ties between NATO and Israel. Now, people remember what was happening in January last year. What you may or may not be aware of is that on January 11th, the Secretary General of NATO paid a visit to Tel Aviv to speak there at a conference and met with Olmert, right in the middle of Operation Cast Lead. And so while Israel is not technically a member of NATO, and NATO didn't publicly support Cast Lead explicitly, what we saw is an implicit support for what Israel was doing during the massacre in Gaza last year. And there's a direct partnership, something called the Mediterranean Dialogue, which I recommend people look into if you haven't heard of it already, which is a direct partnership between Israel and NATO, which centers around security in the Mediterranean. And particularly right now, I think this is even more relevant given the Free Gaza Flotilla is heading through the Mediterranean to deliver humanitarian supplies to the people of Gaza who've been under illegal siege for all this time. And we need to be asking, in addition to the basically half the Israeli Navy that's going to intercept the Free Gaza Flotilla, what's the role of NATO in all of this? You know, that's not explicitly stated, but we know that it's happening. And so that's part of the context that I think we need to look at this in, is that as Rafif and Khaled were mentioning, that there is this direct relationship in terms of the militarism, in terms of the ideology, in terms of the repression that's being leveled against activists here, is that this militarism, the support for the war in Afghanistan for the Harper government, the support for Israel, which is well over the top as we know, they do go hand in hand. But more than that, we need to look at the allegations of anti-Semitism. And we at IJV say, well, you know, you level these accusations that criticizing Israel is anti-Semitic, and we say no. Actually, we're Jewish, and we have a moral imperative to criticize Israel because it claims to represent us in every criminal act that it perpetrates. More than that, though, we need to say criticism of Israel is not enough. We need to actively campaign against the occupation, against the settlement, against the wall, against the impunity, against the siege of Gaza, against the military order to ethnically cleanse Palestinians from the West Bank, and we need to join the movement to boycott, divest, and sanction Israel. And at our annual general meeting last year, that's precisely what IJV did. Nearly unanimously. And I'd just like to highlight as well that, you know, before that annual general meeting last year, groups like the CJC dismissed IJV as, you know, a fringe on the rump of the Jewish community here. And not long after that, just last fall, CJC, the National Post, and others launched a smear campaign against IJV claiming we were anti-Semitic, which really is a key thing that I think we need to expose, because when they say that even a Jewish organization is anti-Semitic, it highlights that's really the only argument that they have. What else do they have? Like, if they actually had a valid criticism, you'd think when they're criticizing a Jewish organization for taking this position, maybe they'd use it, but they've got nothing. So I think this really exposes that. And also, this really highlights the shift that's happening in the Jewish community on these issues. There are growing numbers every day in the Jewish community, I think, that are questioning Israel in more and more profound ways. And we saw this in the lead up to our AGM last year, where our membership and the Jewish community members we were reaching out to, we saw a spike in membership because people knew we were going to be potentially adopting BDS. And this highlights just the dramatic growth in opposition to what Israel is doing in the Jewish community. And certainly there's much more to get into if people want to talk about it. There's the boycott from within in Israel, which includes many Israelis. There's the refusenik, the Shmanistim high school students who refused to join the Israeli military. The list goes on and on. So just to try and be concise, I think another key thing that the previous speakers mentioned is the CPCCA, which is a bit of an acronym to remember, but an important one. That's the Canadian Parliamentary Coalition to Combat Anti-Semitism, so-called. So this is what's been set up by Jason Kenney, Erwin Kotler, and others, as was mentioned. And there have been hearings going on for the last few months. And basically, the ultimate objective of this, as we know, is to at some point introduce legislation that would criminalize criticism of Israel. And this is really what we're up against, and this is one of the key things that highlights how this really is the new McCarthyism. And we need to be preparing on the ground to mobilize against this impending legislation. As Khaled mentioned, the International Parliamentary Coalition to Combat Anti-Semitism meeting here in Canada, it's going to be this November in Ottawa, and it's co-sponsored by the Ministry of Citizenship and Immigration. So, that I think we know who is a fan of that organizing, Jason McCarthy, Kenny. So, and Erwin Kotler, definitely, we cannot forget. So I think knowing that, there's some really serious and important organizing that we can do. And just quickly, I want to get back to the JDL, the so-called Jewish Defense League, which is really the Israeli Defense League. You know, as was mentioned, they advised Kenny on a whole range of issues, whether it's which British parliamentarians they should ban, or a range of other organizations they should cut funding from, including Palestine House. And I think we really need to start exposing the JDL for what they are. You know, Jason Kenney and the Harper government like to talk about how certain British parliamentarians shouldn't be allowed to enter Canada because they allegedly support terrorism. But we need to point out that the JDL, according to the FBI, is a terrorist organization. They engaged in bombing campaigns in the U.S. from 81 to 86. As recently as 2001, members of the JDL were arrested for conspiracy to bomb a mosque and the office of a congressperson in California. And so when this government talks about, well, you know, all these people who are criticizing Israel, they're anti-Semitic, they're supporting terrorists, we need to point out, well, what? Wait a second, this is who you're taking your advice from on these issues, the organization that's listed as a terrorist organization by the FBI? I think a lot of people will recognize that for what it is when we point that out. And so Kenny justified the Galloway ban on these baseless allegations, and we also need to point out that JDL claimed credit for this decision. So IJV is a proud member of the BDS movement and a proud member of the Canadian Peace Alliance. And with the time remaining, I just want to suggest a few things that we can collectively do to continue to build the movement. One is we hope you'll join the peace movement rally on June 26th during the G20 because of the link that we've already mentioned between the Palestine Solidarity Movement and the movement to end the war. Certainly there's lots of opportunities to protest Netanyahu coming up, which I think people may be aware of, and certainly I hope we'll all see you at Pride with T-shirts that say Quiet on them. And just a couple other key things. In terms of building this movement, as I mentioned, there are a lot of areas of potential movement convergence. So just to highlight a few, you know, our opponents keep opening up these new fronts in the struggle, and I think the more we can turn two fronts or more into one, the greater our chances are of success. So one thing we can look at, for example, is the Canadian use of Israeli Predator drones in Afghanistan. We can fight against the war in Afghanistan while engaging in BDS, and that's just one example. We can look at the deepening partnership between NATO and Israel that I mentioned, and we can also expose and continue to organize against the Israel lobby's support for the war in Afghanistan, Canadian militarism, Islamophobia, and silencing free speech. And just to end, as I mentioned, I think it's helpful to not consider the groups like CJC, B'nai B'rith, JDL as a Jewish lobby, because primarily they're not really representing Jews, they're representing corporate interests. The heads of CIJA, the Canadian Israel Jewish Advocacy Organization, actually sit on various boards, including CIBC and Via Rail. And so I think it would be, you know, there are a range of other things that we can call them, including, you know, the Zionist lobby, the pro-Israel lobby, maybe even the pro-apartheid lobby. But we need to be clear that they do not speak for the Jewish community, and there are growing voices like IJV in Canada and around the world who are engaging in real Palestinian solidarity, real defense of human rights. And I know many of you are already involved in that struggle, and I look forward to seeing you in the streets.
Hi. Thank you all for being here on Saturday morning. I wanted to try to do two things. First, take a kind of a longer view of this notion of McCarthyism, and then focus on what's happening in Toronto, especially intensely over the past couple of weeks around Pride and Quiet, in terms of trying to understand how this McCarthyism we're dealing with is different from and similar to the McCarthyism that many of us had, well, not me, but I remember it, that people dealt with in the 50s. That original McCarthyism, I think we need to look at the kind of social context in which that was taking place. First of all, it was the end of the New Deal, that massive government intervention in the economy to try to pull the quote-unquote developed world out of the Depression. It was also a time when there was concerted efforts to roll back gender relations that had shifted dramatically as women were pulled into the workforce when men were off fighting in World War II. And it was also a time when the alliance between democracies and socialism against fascism suddenly had to flip so that we became an alliance against communism in the Cold War. So what we see is, I think we can look at that McCarthyist period and those trials and hearings and things as a kind of public performance that attempts to orchestrate a really rapid ideological retooling of society. Right? We've got people who like have thought that, oh yes, we have to. Socialism isn't so bad. Fascism isn't the enemy. Women have to do their part. Government has to be involved in the economy, and all of a sudden, public opinion needs to be shifted 180 degrees. And so if we see the McCarthy period as an attempt to produce that kind of shift through the public discipline of people who now are identified as being the other, the outside, the danger, that gives us an analytical tool to begin to look at what's happening today. What is the performance that's going on today? What is the shift that we're trying to accomplish here? Now, the context today, I think, or I would argue, is much more complicated. even than it was back in the 50s. First, we've got this neoliberal globalization, which is transforming world economies and which has, because of its own internal contradictions, entered into a period of crisis at this point. Second is growing class disparities in the developed world. Countries such as Canada, we're seeing differences between wealth and poverty, such as we haven't seen since the 20s and 30s, because of the neoliberal turn in the economy. Third, the penetration of these liberal ideas and values, the rationality of markets into all aspects of life, so that everything needs to be understood in terms of whether it produces value or not. So we're no longer students in schools, we're clients, right? We're consumers. All of that kind of talk, which is kind of corroding all kinds of social bonds and communities and notions of solidarity, a whole wide range of them. Fourth, a period of inter-imperialist rivalries over scarce resources. Right. Suddenly, oil becomes something that everybody needs, and so there's all sorts of jockeying going on in the world. A spontaneous, I would say, very conservative reaction among those resource-rich countries to the despoilation of their countries in terms of this process. Third, within the developed world, an increasing reliance on socially conservative actors in order to shore up governments who are trying to deal with these increasing, what I would call class contradictions. So increased reliance, say, for the Harper government on the Christian right, and kind of a national chauvinist current within the Jewish community that's organized around Israel, kind of ethnic nationalism there. And so we see the same kinds of performances taking place, the so-called parliamentary committee, the public banning of George Galloway, custom funding to Kairos and to the Canadian Arab Federation, show trials of homegrown terrorists, which always seem to kind of peter out at the end because there really isn't much evidence against anybody. Threats against free speech in universities around Israeli apartheid, weak B'nai-B'rith attempts to stir up real fears in the Jewish community that they're somehow under attack, threats that have become so outrageous that even Jonathan Kay of the National Post has begun to point out that they're really going overboard on this. So there's an ideological retooling going on here again, right, as we shift from that notion of the old Keynesian multicultural welfare state kind of model to this new harsh, more racist, more aggressive neoliberal model, which also requires increasing militarism in terms of the inter-imperialist rivalries and the struggle for resources. And bizarrely, we have seen in the past week all of this beginning to play out in the queer community in Toronto, right, which isn't exactly the space you'd expect that such, you know, broad struggles would find their focal point, but indeed, because of a whole range of reasons, it has, right? And so then we have to look at this notion of queer community or gay community or Latina gay community in Toronto and what that means, right? Because that as well is a very, very complicated terrain, right? Almost as complicated as those kinds of social forces that are now beginning to come together in this fight around Gay Pride Day. Who'd ever thought, right? One, this is a community with still an historical memory of what it felt like to be excluded and criminalized, right? And long struggles in terms of free speech and attempting to gain legal rights and overturn unjust laws and discrimination. I mean, that's still within the historical memory of most of us in the queer community. But as well, it's a community that has been dramatically affected by the class polarization that we've seen under neoliberalism, right? So that with these rights won, there are certain sectors in that community who, if they properly perform their gender and their race and their class, can now rub shoulders with the ruling class on an equal basis, And then there are other people in that community who, because they can't perform those things, they don't belong to those things, find themselves more and more marginalized from life, despite all of the legal gains that have been won through years of political struggle in the community. And so those class differences are now expressing themselves in political contradictions as well. Some people wanting to assimilate more, just blend in, become like everybody else, and other people saying, you know, we don't want this system, it's excluding us, and becoming more and more resistant to it. And there's a generational aspect to that, as well as a class aspect to that. So how that has actually transpired on the ground through a series of events around Quaya. Quaya isn't an organization. We have maybe going on for about 3 years now. Have maybe 20 people show up to most meetings. We can pull up maybe a couple of hundred at Pride Day of supporters. Has been engaging in Pride for the last, this would be the third year now. Last year, B'nai B'rith launched a campaign to try to prevent Quaya from marching in Pride. Now, unfortunately for them, B'nai B'rith didn't have a lot of cred in terms of that constellation of community forces that I just talked about. Generally a straight organization, it has actually dramatically stopped supporting gay rights issues in recent years. Its lead spokesman, Frank Diamond, actually teaches at Canadian Christian College, which is McVetty's college, which is kind of a hotbed of right-wing Christian fundamentalism. You know, he's not the best spokesperson to be suggesting to Pride who or who not should be marching in the Pride parade. So up comes a gay man called Martin Gladstone, who puts together a video about the Pride parade. And if people haven't seen it, well, you might want to just look at the short 10 minutes, the short kind of trailer that's on the internet. Kind of classic propaganda technique. You know, there's pictures of choir marching with scary music, and then pictures of other people marching with happy music. There was one kid in the choir contingent who wore one of those old anti-fascist T-shirts, you know, the circle with the swastika and the cross through it, which has now been transformed by Gladstone and the media into an army of people donning swastikas to denounce Israel. I mean, really, really crazy stuff. But also Gladstone had been working hard to convince Pride that the Jewish community was under attack and that it needed extra police to protect Kulame, which is the gay social group that several Kulame members used to belong to, from attacks by terrorists. And then the hate crimes unit, of course, called Kulanu, and suddenly they became terrified, right? Right on cue. Because, of course, the hate crimes unit was telling them they needed special protection in Pride Day. So they whipped up all of this kind of fear in the Jewish community. And Quaya has had no quarrel with Kulanu, you know, a social group and a political group, you know, at opposite ends of the parade. But really, they were the last things on anybody's mind. Gladstone also took his video and began to do work with Pride funders and people in the city. And here you begin to see the self-referential kind of ideological formation of this campaign. Because Gladstone references the parliamentary committee, right? And he references the motion that was passed at the provincial parliament denouncing Israeli apartheid as hate speech, right? A unanimous motion that involved 30 MPs at the end of the day when everybody was asleep, and which has absolutely no legal value whatsoever. It's a completely symbolic notion. That notion was also referenced by the director of the Board of Education, who banned Israeli apartheid activities in the Board of Education, the Toronto District School Board, despite the fact that men had been organized. Right. When we met with city officials to find out what in the world was going on, they actually referenced the Board of Education's banning of Israeli apartheid to justify the banning of it at Pride Day. Right. Even though they said, well, no complaints were ever investigated, there were no findings, and there's absolutely no evidence that anybody broke any city discrimination policies or that the term Israeli apartheid constitutes hate speech. Right. So that series of events has produced this week's dramatic announcement that Israeli apartheid as a term, or any other words that, it's a bizarre word, it's very ungrammatical, that lead to the same notion, I think the resolution says, will not be allowed in the Pride Parade. And that, of course, has produced a huge opposition in the queer community, right? An opposition which is also very entangled. There are people who really don't have any stake at all in Middle East politics, but are absolutely infuriated about what's going on in terms of free speech because of that historical memory and because of the success of that penetration of liberal values, which says free speech is a good thing, right? Here we're looking at a real contradiction in the neoliberal attack on the notion of Israeli apartheid, because they're saying free speech on the one hand is really important, on the other hand it shouldn't be applied here. And so when you look at the Pride resolution, you get this thing where we believe in free speech, therefore we're going to have to ban the term Israeli apartheid. We believe in inclusivity, therefore we're going to have to exclude people from the parade, right? And so it becomes a complete incoherent mess when they try to articulate that position. So the free speechers, the people who are interested in, you know, the left in the gay movement, who's always been interested in anti-colonial struggles and anti-racist struggles, you know, the old dinosaurs from the body politic years. It's amazing to see people that I hadn't seen in years and years, the demonstration that happened on Tuesday morning. And then youth, a lot of youth who are completely disaffected because of the position that neoliberal economics has been putting them in, expressing their dissatisfaction with Pride in general. And this kind of leads us into the final thing, how this has become a lightning rod for all sorts of people who are dissatisfied with this corporate turn in Pride, who see that Pride is now more an exercise in delivering us to advertisers than it is the queer community expressing what its issues and what its concerns really are. So what we're seeing, I think, on the ground, and why this is also complicated, is an ideological struggle around this retooling of culture, right, which is now being played out in a queer community which both reflects the new neoliberal turn and also resists it at the same time. And just one kind of final thing that I wanted to leave with you that I thought was interesting, though I'm not quite sure of all the implications. When I was arrested back in the 70s, or was it the 80s, for publishing The Body Politic, what was banned was talk about sex. Right? That's where you couldn't go. If you talked about sex, they would arrest you. Right? Politics, you could talk about all you wanted. That was fine. Now, what's being banned is politics. And what Pride says, people should be talking about sex and sexual liberation. So, what does that mean? What has that shift? You know, how does sexuality play in this neoliberal turn? Right? I think we need to begin to really think about that, right? Because sex is no longer the thing that cannot speak its name. Politics has become the thing that cannot speak its name. Thank you.
So thank you to Tim and all the speakers. We've got about 20 minutes or so for discussion. There's lots of people in the room here who are involved in all these struggles, so we hope we can hear from you and what your experience has been. What I'll do, I'll take a speaker's list. So if you want to speak, just raise your hand. I'll acknowledge you. I'll put you on the list. And if you can keep your comments to about 2 minutes, or questions or whatever, that way we'll get as many people as possible on the list. So who would like to start off the discussion?
Thanks very much to all the speakers. Learned a lot. I hope I didn't lose anything at all. I want to bring up a couple of points. One is, for those of you, I don't know if you've been to the Pride Parade, but there's such a great vibe at the Pride Parade. It's unlike any other event, especially at that.
You stand up.
Sorry. Especially at that side. I've been told that Toronto Police actually really like being posted to duty on the Pride Parade because nothing ever goes wrong. People are in such a good mood. It's a big party, you know, and so that's important because there's so much fear mongering going on right now. And I've heard claims about animosity, about what choir members might do and so on. And it's just not true. You know, they take part, you know, last year there was nothing. There's no threat of violence. So, you know, when people are, when you're trying to consider the two sides of an argument and you're trying to figure out who may be on the right side, consider, you know, when people are trying to ban words, or they're saying that you can't take them in there, what are they afraid of? You know, there's a big push to try and create, to give your mother to create fear of what these people might do, and try to suppress just conversation, dialogue about this issue.
Oh, thank you so much to all the panelists. This was an excellent, excellent discussion. And I guess I'd like to kind of grapple with some of the points that people have raised. I do agree that it is an interesting time that we're living in, because as was mentioned at the beginning, we've got a real economic instability. We have a situation where there is inter-imperialist rivalry, but in the context where the U.S. is actually, its hegemony is weakening, and so the stakes in so many ways are much higher for the U.S. And when you think about the context of the Arab world and the whole geopolitical machinations of that area, the historical role that Israel has played as the watchdog of U.S. imperialism obviously plays a role. And you can imagine in a period where there is economic instability, there is with the growing inequalities, there is more political instability, and I mean, just events around the world over the last 2 months are really astonishing, from Thailand to Kyrgyzstan to Greece and so on and so forth. So you have more political instability at the base. But this is when all of these kind of things are taking place. And so in some ways, the ideological retooling is, an expression of a ruling class that is increasingly desperate, actually. And it feels to me like more and more there's an air of desperation in terms of the activities of the ruling class trying to come to grips with, with how they're solidarity and so on and so forth. This isn't totally worked out, but I was thinking about the situation where, on the one hand, the ruling class, especially in the post 9/11 period with the rise of Islamophobia, has been, cultivating the fear of the Muslim community. And one area that they've worked very hard at trying to pit communities against communities is actually pitting the Muslim community against the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community by going and appealing to the most conservative elements by the Muslim community and stirring that kind of stuff up and so on and so forth. And at the same time, whenever there's, threats to lesbian gay rights, the image that the media will often portray is, mobilizing the mosques and so forth. So it's kind of perpetuating some of that stuff. But when you, when folks talk about, or when Kimmy talked about this whole question of sexuality is now we're able to talk about it, it struck me that in so many ways, the only thing left is, for people to hang their hats on the difference between Western liberal democracies and other countries is actually the question of sexuality and actually extreme sexualization and gentrification of women in so many ways. So, when you think about it, it's like, here in the West, women, can be as naked as they want, and there isn't a problem about it. But we eject when women are covered in other regions. We have, when you kind of think about all that stuff, to imagine what's happening in the Pride Parade, where you actually have a coalescing of the gay and lesbian community in solidarity with the Muslim community around the issue of Palestine, like, it's almost like a quadruple whammy for the ruling class. And so it seems to me that, it is true that these issues are coming together. We are building this kind of, connections, and I think if we can thread these things through and deepen our analysis, I think, we're going to be able to put some of these things forward in a much more clear way and kind of accelerate the process. So, again, thank you for raising all those really excellent points, and I think it's been a great discussion.
I just wanted to say that I'm sort of quiet and just in lots of meetings going around with other folks in the queer community. They hate that we're being banned, but people want to frame it mostly around free speech. And that's good. It is about that. It is about censorship, but they don't really want to take on the power case to them of Palestine. And, we've been trying to explain that Palestine is being censored. Like, you don't even want to say the word among some Jews, there are no Palestinians. So I'm wondering, how can we knit this together? Because this is a special moment. Like, there have been people unhappy about Pride, I'm one of them. And, you know, it's great that we talk about sex, but that's not the only thing going on. How do we get this together and start to not just create this broad, well, I prefer a community of bras, not bras, community sometimes. But they want, they're interested in, I haven't had enough coffee. I'm looking at their cut their heels. The interest that I'm getting from other people in the queer community is, let's not make this too controversial. Let's try and bring all people in. But in doing that, I can remember in Jewish anti-occupation communities, let's not talk about right of return. Telling Palestinians to So I think we need to think about that and say, fine, we know that it's controversial for people, but if we don't say the word now, then it never gets said. And so how do we strategize around that smartly so that we can bring people in? We have a chance right now. And how do we make people in the queer community see that this is not just about what's going on in Pride, although it is, because there's a lot of other things involved with the whole issue out around Pride. But how do we get people to see that this is part of the larger struggle against dissent, against what Israel is doing in Canada, implicit and now export support?
Cool. Can I answer that, or is there any questions?
Yeah, I'll take a couple more questions, and maybe we'll do a...
My name is Terry. I'm actually in the CW, and as you know, some of the people, there was a resolution in our union that became well known that passed the support of the PDS campaign.
First National Union to do it.
And the first resolution. Well, I don't have any big answers, but I'm going to try to tell you what the problem is in my union. And I've been in very heated debate with a lot of members and leaders in my union over the last 2 or 3 weeks over this very issue because of the quiet thing that came up. Because it came up, it's like, we've got to get some stuff organized with Pride ourselves, you know, we're being contingent. And it's like, well, what are we going to say about this issue? Do we have a resolution or not? You know? And I don't have time to get into a big long story about it, but in short, from the time that resolution was passed, the very next day, a brick went through the office window in Ottawa, and instantly all the leaders who were ousted or re-elected or something, that was all about them, and there was a few of them saying, no, that's not about you, it's about the resolution, okay? And then the response of the national office was quite good in the next few months. They hammered out a lot of really informative stuff about Palestine in good literature that can go on shop tour boards and stuff. And then when the Constitution came out, our book that some of our homes have, ironically, okay, pages were cut and it is not written into our Constitution. So when that happened, I thought, oh boy, I bet you there's a few stuff about that going on because something's going to say, oh, then a printing error, you know? So I didn't learn until a couple of weeks ago that actually the people in our national office are in a debate about how this resolution came to be. They believe that it wasn't debated at the lower levels, and that's why it wasn't really a solid resolution. But in fact, it was passed unanimously in Toronto. No debate. Because at the time, there was no influence of significance going on out there by the Zionist lobby that would say that using the word Israeli apartheid is connected to anti-Semitism. People weren't aware of this yet, so it seemed like a harmless resolution to most people. I have about 1,000 other things to say, but I'm going to respect the show.
Thank you.
Great presentation. I think it presents the pathway around the Pride Parade with a tremendous opportunity in a sense. I mean, what Tim was saying, if you go back to the roots of gay liberation, where did the gay liberation movement come from? It was because there was a tremendous affinity with activists in that era with the National Liberation Front of Vietnam and colonial struggles around the world. That anti-imperialist sense was a part of the activism, obviously, in permeating the entire community. But the whole question of culturalization of Pride has been an issue for many, many years. But what is happening right now, for all the reasons the panelists and others have said, is an incredible tragedy. And I think what Pride is doing, but beyond that, I mean, what others of us who have, I mean, I'm a member of the Guild of 59 Steelworkers, what others of us who traditionally march in that parade with our constituencies, what are we going to do? And I think what we're going to do is continue to march, because I think boycotting is a huge mistake, and essentially gives a platform and a victory to those forces that are trying to quash this debate and quash the whole question of Palestinian struggle and everything that it entails. And I think what we should do over the next month is fight very hard to have whatever contingents we have do what we can, because they're not looking at the steelworkers, they're not looking at Qatar, they're not looking at any of us to throw us out. But if we go there and we have either Palestinian flag or whatever else, and if you were talking about marching with bandanas with X's across, you know, that type of thing, so that it is fully integrated into the pride parade and lets the organizers, lets the marshals cry. And what we're trying to do, and we've always done the United Steelworkers, most of the people who march in our contingent happen to be straight, who are allies and supporters. Let them cry, and I think it would be, they're not going to do it. They're not going to do it. And I think that if we can get out there, the importance of building the contingent, having a statement, however you choose to make it, you can make it in all different kinds of ways, and allow, which is going to be a huge issue politically on the day because of all the fruit crops, and let it be seen that the gay community, the LGBTQ community in this city is not going to be silenced, the Palestinian issues have to be silenced, and it will be a victory, and I think a whole step forward in the struggle.
So just let people know, I have four speakers on the list. If there's any other speakers who want to speak, please indicate now. We're going to have to move very quickly so that the panel has some time to come back and respond. I've got you on the list, so how do you know?
Well,
I will
go to a question. I'll say very quickly that one of the things that I've been struggling with that thing too in debates in the LGBT community about, you know, people wanting to just brand it, well, it's a free speech issue, this is a free speech issue, and so on. And of course, that's a very good starting point, because that is one of those kinds of liberal values that people hold very dearly, and so on. But I would say, well, you know, it begs the question of who's trying to put an end to free speech, and that's, of course, a segue to, you know, the power structures, the Israel lobby, and so on. But one of the things that I've encountered is that people just don't know the history, right? And it's and of course the common refrain is, oh, it's so complex, right? And I don't typically hear people on the left or Palestinians saying, oh, it's too complex. We can't, it comes from a model that comes from the Zionist, right? It's too complex, right? It's just sort of stand in the eye, stand in the circle, saying all kinds of random historical facts, and you feel overwhelmed because you don't know how to respond, because they know this, their version of history very well, and so on. So I always say to people, and I remember when I was talking to people, I was like, well, just family members who don't know anything about the history, or just some friends who are members of the LGBT community who aren't, and who see all my Facebook postings and the activism I'm doing, and they get curious and say, well, what's that all about? And they say, no, I don't really, I haven't been fighting was going on for centuries. And I'm saying, well, you know, fighting has been going on for centuries, but this particular quote unquote conflict, right, really all stems from just the ethnic cleansing of Palestine between 47 and 49. And then just say, if you want to understand 1950 to 2010, you just have to start with 1947 to 49. Everything follows. And so if you can really quickly explain to people about the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, and I've been getting good enough to do it in a paragraph or less, people suddenly go, you just draw some parallels with what has happened elsewhere, you know, in history and around the world, and people come to go, oh, really? You know, it's basically their land was seized and they were violently expelled, and the resistance ever since, and they don't have a state, they don't have a military. So I find once I make that point, people who don't know anything about history suddenly, the issues no longer apply.
A great panel, and I think one of the ways we keep the discussion going, we don't know what we have to do around pricing, but one of the ways the discussion has to keep going is by recognizing the importance of the ability of pricing, which gives the opportunity to sort of like sit down and have the types of panels and discussions and plan strategy and plan for next year. And I think one of the reasons why this chart is going on, the importance of what Lizzie was saying, is the BDS call. It's also the fact that two is really hard. I mean, that call is finding a hearing all across countries all over the world. I'm a member of Independent Jewish Voices as well. And the first year that we had a meeting, it was a very quiet operation. I was a straw vote on recognizing the Palestinian right of return, and not even a majority of the delegates in Independent Jewish Voices voted for that. And I really had a very, ambivalent relationship with this whole operation. The following year, there was a decision to adopt the boycott, divest, and sanctions. And in talking to people, many, many, many delegates in the Jewish Voices had made it a priority to participate in the Israeli project meeting, whatever city that they were in. And that's where they shifted their views. It was through the Palestinian call, through Israeli project meeting, and then saying, I get this. It's a complete change of the way in which organizing is taking place. So what we're up against here, I think, is we have to know that it's not the analysis of apartheid or saying the group is really submissive. The whole post-war structure of the Catholic state has been based on the submissive notion, which is absolute as Palestinians and presented Israel as a progressive state. And it's just a myth. And Tim was talking about experiences in the 1970s and 80s, and I'll suggest my age here. I was a founding member of the International Socialist in the mid-1970s, was in the height of the Cold War, and we had an analysis that Russia was a state capital of society when the whole world thought it was a socialist or a communist state. And it reminds me very much of the kind of conversation we were having about the early apartheid. It's like, no, it's reactionary. I don't care what the right now, let's look at the history, let's look at the story, look at the people who are inside the Soviet Empire. Now it's quite understood. People, are not nostalgic for, the old Russian communism in that way. But I think we have a similar mythology to take apart. Israel's not a democracy. It's an apartheid state. It's not compensation for the Jews who were the victims of the Nazi Holocaust. That victimization, which is some Western anti-Semitism, which you still have to come to terms with, and even in terms of the labor movement, relations with the Israeli union movement, et cetera, is a relationship with reactionary Jewish, history of Jewish-only organizing. So we have a lot of work to do over here. I'm very glad, it's a horrible situation, but I'm very glad that the argument is extended into the question of hate and lesbian rights and what that means. It was an opportunity for us to continue the education.
Yeah. Marie?
On that same note, I just wanted to mention that my knowledge of the Middle East has been fairly limited, but having been involved in the nuclear issues for a long time, it was certainly this that got me reading, got me thinking about what was really going on, and I wanted to be in solidarity with Palestine. And certainly there are a couple things. There's an alternative day march happening on the Saturday, taking things out of the context of Pride back to a political organization, Mason Phillips Square at 2 o'clock, and also to mention that Jason Kenney will be in town on June 9th for a meeting at the Economic Club in the morning, so might be an opportunity to let you know.
Okay, so the last speaker will be Hunter Guy.
I actually just have a question. For the guy, if you could answer why MacArthur is so focused on.
Okay. So we have about 5 minutes left for the speakers to respond to all of those questions. And what I'm going to suggest is that this is obviously an ongoing discussion, and we hope that we can organize more spaces like this where we can elaborate and have more time for discussion. I'll make two quick announcements before we resume. There are a number of resources related to this talk that I encourage you to pick up in the book room. There's the Labor for Palestine resource produced by Labor for Palestine, which is part of the Coalition Against Israeli Apartheid. This is available in the book room. There's also a pamphlet on the Nakba, which one of the speakers mentioned, the ethnic cleansing of 750 Palestinians in 1948. So I encourage you to pick up those. We also have our newspaper, Socialist Worker, which is produced by the organization that put on this event. I encourage you to pick up a copy of that. And everyone, I think, in this room probably knows that tomorrow at 9 a.m. we are assembling at just opposite the Princess Gate by the CNE to unwelcome war criminal Benjamin Netanyahu, who will be in town to kick off the Walk with Israel. We hope that all of you will be there. Use today and the time before the rally to encourage as many people as possible to participate. So with that, we'll give you a minute each to try to summarize as quickly as possible and whatever sequence you prefer.
Okay,
so I'm sorry.
Okay, so
I think that old notion that in Chinese the word for crisis is made up of two symbols, one is danger and one is opportunity, right? It comes together. I can think of only a few times in, you know, a lot of political activism that I found myself in the center of such a crisis, right? One would probably be the arrest for the body politic, the second would be the bath raids, right? And this is the thing happening around pride. And so we suddenly find ourselves involved in what is probably as close to a mass movement as one is expected to find in the city of Toronto, right? And that means that we need to do coalition politics, and doing coalition politics is an art, right? And you've got to figure out what the basis of unity is and all of those kinds of things. And yes, there's a danger that our issues could get lost. I'd prefer to focus on the fact of this being a huge opportunity for us to talk about these issues among people who have been drawn into this crisis with no knowledge of what happens in the Middle East. It's kind of one of these Foucauldian moments where they have attempted to, by banning discourse around a certain term, have made that discourse explode, right? So the opposite that they have intended is taking place. And I mean, to think that Alan Lee, I don't know if people know, read the Star this morning, who's been involved in Gays in Toronto and AIDS stuff for years and years and years, and was nominated for Grand Marshal this year at Pride. And Alan has been involved in a lot of politics. He doesn't know squat about Mideast, right? I mean, this is not his culture, not his background, not his issue. Like, this is like, there's no organic links to them, right? But if you read his statement to Pride, he talks about not just free speech stuff, but how this is an important human rights issue that needs to be talked about, right? So, you know, this thing has suddenly, it's produced a conversation and a discourse among groups of people who had never been involved in this before, and it's up to us to figure out how to manage that in such a way that we don't become so frightened of losing our message that we isolate ourselves and use this as an opportunity of getting that message across to whole new people.
So, 1 minute. Just quickly, I think a key thing in terms of what we can continue to do is build links with other movements. I talked a little bit about the anti-war movement. I think another key one is increasing our work around indigenous solidarity. Lots of us in the Palestine Solidarity Movement have already been doing that. And, just to, make one quick connection, as Khaled mentioned, the government's attempt to kick him and Ali Mala out of the leadership of CAF. Another example of a similar activity is the Canadian state removing the elected leadership of the Barrier Lake First Nation, and basically because of their opposition to resource extraction and the kind of operations that we know all too well that happened. So this is, definitely something that's been focused on the Arab and Muslim community, but also indigenous communities here. And we can build on those links and highlight that, when groups like CJC want to take folks in the indigenous community over to Israel and say, the Jewish liberation struggle is the same as the indigenous liberation struggles here, we need to say that actually, it's Palestinian self-determination that's most parallel. So just quickly, why is Harper so pro-Israel? Long panel discussion could happen on that, but basically ideology, militarism, geopolitics, and its growing base in the Christian right are just a few of that long list. And just two other quick things. If we want to extend this just beyond the question of free speech, how do we talk about the Palestine question as well for people who are less comfortable about that? We can link it to things like the legislative attempt to ban mourning of the Nakba in Israel. The attack on free speech there is connected to the attack on free speech here. And just lastly, there's been a call out, I don't know if people have seen it, but for a day of action against Jason Kenney on July 24th from Known as Illegal in Vancouver. And I think that's something we could look at to bring together the Palestine Solidarity Movement, the war resistors, the removal of LGBT mentioned in the citizenship guide, and oh so much more to really focus on the need to fire Kenny.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to stress that this attack against the gay community, against the Palestine Solidarity activity, is nothing new. It's just a continuation of what this government has been doing, or these governments have been doing, with the Anti-Terrorism Act, there was already an undermining of the civil rights of Canadian citizens even. And then laws that were passed or being passed now, changes to the Immigration Act, which affect immigrants and refugees. Refugees now will be judged not because of their individual case, but because if they come from a country which is identified by this government as a safe country, they have no chance, which is against the Refugee Convention. Because the Refugee Convention says each case should be analyzed individually. And finally, this government, in the case of Omar Khadr, has not accepted to protect a Canadian child, and it is a signatory to the Convention for the Protection of Children, which states child soldiers are not responsible for their actions. They should be repatriated and integrated into society. They did that in Sierra Leone for 20,000 children, and Canada is washing its hands from this from these rights. So this is a continuation of these undermining of the civil rights of Canadians, and we should take it into that. And they are using, the corporations and the government are using financial blackmail. In our case, we lost $1.5 million. We had 15 staff. Now we have one staff, but we are independent. And I think they use that against Pride for the same reason. And in the end, I feel it's better to be independent and be able to do what you believe in instead of being just employed.
Thank you, Howard. And repeat.
I want to speak about the other side of this coin, which we didn't mention a lot. Which, on the one hand, they're trying to shut us down, and there's all the attempts to shut down the term Israeli apartheid. On the other, because of this neoliberal moment and trying to save the scraps, we are seeing a closer relationship between Israel and in Canada, but in this case specifically Ontario, with McGuinty being in Israel right now talking about having tighter relationships. And this is the work we can do, is also point out that these relationships are growing. Their response to the BDS movement has been to travel over there and try to bridge more links. And one of the things McGuinty has said is he really appreciates the Israeli immigration system and would like to see some of it implemented here. And that's one heck of a racist, like Kenny would be proud of that immigration system. So we have to look at the other side of the coin as well, and these relationships that are growing, and make sure that the BDS movement targets them. Very quickly on the issue of free speech versus using the term Israeli apartheid, I don't think we should counterpose or put these things as a dichotomy. You either speak about free speech or you talk about Israeli apartheid in Palestine. I agree with Tim. I think coalition building is an art, and I think one of the major successes of the BDS movement in Toronto is that we've been able to work with everybody really slowly and build. When there's an opportunity to speak about free speech and mention Palestine, that is an opening for us that we need to take. And the slow work of education is really slow work. But once we are able to have these platforms and explain the situation, talk about the BDS call, we've seen people turn. As Abby said, in the first IJV conference, I walked out because people who had nothing to do with Palestine were debating my right to return to my land. So I walked out of it. But this, in 1 year's time, with people attending Israeli apartheid week, they were able to take a vote on it and join the BDS movement. So these moments are not static moments. People change. We need to build coalitions. And our motto within the Coalition Against Israeli Apartheid has been, take whatever space you can, just be in there, talk about Palestine, and it's that slow education that's going to change people. We cannot afford not to be in certain places and to boycott certain places. And for everybody marching in Pride, I think they've banned the word Israeli apartheid, so what we need to do is carry the word Israeli apartheid, wear t-shirts that say the word Israeli apartheid, and be in there and see what we can do. Thank you.